Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp for the New Books Network, the Native American Studies channel. I'm here today with Tore Peterson. He is professor of International and American Diplomatic History at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Welcome, Professor Peterson.
Thank you very much.
What we usually do on the show is talk a little bit about the cover. You have an interesting illustration sketch on the cover. Can you elaborate on that for our listeners?
This is from the little fingernail ledger that was captured from the Giants in January 1879. And it's named after the owner, Little Fingernail. And he had it on his body. And you see to the right, the bullet pierced right through it. So, and also the Giants were confined to barracks at Fort Robinson this fall. And in January, they broke out because they didn't want to go back to south. And several of the Giants in confinement contributed to the Giant Ledger book or Little Finger Ledger book. And I think it's an important window into Giant history. And I'm not that great of an expert to read it, but somebody who is saying that the Giant culture is dead now, it's totally wrong, because to me it seems to be very vibrant.
So the focus of your book, the title is The Military Conquest of the Prairie, which involves the Cheyenne, Native American Resistance, Evasion, and Survival, 1865 to 1890. How did you approach United States, quoting you, genocide and Native American warfare on the prairie?
You know, this has been a project of mine long way coming, even when I have a PhD in American history from the University of Minnesota. And while studying there, I took a lot of classes in Native American history because they had a Native American studies program. And since 1996, I traveled each summer on the prairie, visiting reservations, museums, and battlefields. And a few years ago, I can't recall which, but there was a biography coming out on Custer. And reading it, I thought I knew more about the author than the author, and I just tried to write out what I knew or had collected, you know, materials for many, many years, and it suddenly dawned on me when going through the material that you can have a different approach, try to look at this from the Native American side. So that's what I've tried to do.
Can you elucidate or elaborate on the introductory statement that, quote, a central argument in this book is that the Native Americans were superior fighters over the military or any white man in a confrontation?
Well, I should probably have qualified it, but I didn't know I was going to be on your show. The point is, when the Indians, the Native Americans, choose to fight, they usually won. And it's quite amazing because they were usually inferior in numbers and armaments. But I can't think of any one-on-one confrontation where there's a clear army victory. You know, because I don't count attacking sleeping villages as, you know, a fair fight.
Pretty prominent military figures from United States history figure largely into your book. One in particular is General William Tecumseh Sherman. In 1866, you argue that he did not need to order the killing of women and children when the army attacked and slaughtered a Sioux village at dawn. How did he advocate wholesale extermination? Can you elaborate on that?
Well, there are not numerous quotes, you know, but most important, for instance, after the Fetterman fight in December 1866, when it says, we have to act with vindictive earnestness against the Sioux to exterminate men, women, children, you know, everybody. And also, when he condoned the army practice of attacking sleeping villages, usually 2/3 of the victims were women and children. So he didn't have to say anything about it, but just condoning it and promoting it, he put himself in a position that most of the people killed were non-combatants.
Can you also touch on a scholarly debate that appears in your, that's related to this, a scholarly debate in your book over the extermination of the buffalo.
Yes. Basically, most of the debate has been that when getting buffalo skins, hides, for the tanning or for industrial work in 1871 in New York, it opened the market and hence the wholesale hunting and slaughter of buffalo. And some Native American historians or historians of the environment says, well, the Native Americans have a huge part in this because they slaughtered or killed buffaloes for teepees, for food, and for the market. But there are two problems with that. First of all, it's they probably exaggerate the numbers of Native Americans in the South. And before the slaughter started in 1872, there were about estimated 7 million buffaloes in the on the southern plains. So that's one of it. And the other one is that this historian said the Indians slaughtered basically cows and hindered reproduction. But I mean, with 7 million buffaloes and perhaps up to 3.5 million calves produced annually, you know, my estimate is that the Native Americans could not kill more than about 200,000 buffaloes. So there were plenty left for wolf predation and reproduction. So it's the white hide hunters that killed the buffalo. And hence, I think the debate is rather moot, to put it mildly.
So the following is a two-part question. First, can you explain how power operated in Plains Native communities, how it was devolved to the warriors and their societies, the most famous of which was the Cheyenne Dog Soldiers? And then second, you note that this particular example where they were very conscious of their power and effectively blocked much of the westward moving settlement of Kansas for almost a decade. So, A, how did power operate within Plains Native communities, and in particular, B, the Cheyenne, and can you touch on a little bit how they blocked moving settlement of the settlement of Kansas?
Okay, I'll try. First of all, you know, these are, in my view, fairly highly organized societies. In usual times, peace chiefs run the tribe, you know, determining where to camp, where to move, to go to war, and things like that. But in times of crisis, the young men in the tribes, you know, have to protect and defend the tribe, and hunt, and hence power devolved in their direction, because they would be able to decide to go to war to make peace or fight or not to fight. The other thing is when you look at Kansas, my argument is that the Dog Soldiers were very effective in blocking westward migration for almost a decade in western Kansas.
For our listeners, can you trace the causes of the 1874-1875 Red River War and explain why the infamous Battle of Palo Duro Canyon, which I'd like you to elaborate on, was little more than a skirmish with few, if any, immediate consequences?
Yes, because first of all, the war itself, my argument is that the federal government was tired of having Native Americans not submitting to white authorities and going to the reservation. And also, you know, I argue elsewhere in the book that the tribes after 1865-69 were essentially divided in three parts. One part stayed on the reservation the whole year. One part stayed outside in the summer. And the third never came into the reservation. And in the South, we talk about basically the Quality Comanches and most of the Southern Cheyennes, and probably 50 to 60 Kiowa warriors who refused to submit. And this is also tied into the expansion of the buffalo hunting. They went south, the buffalo hunters went south of the Arkansas River in 1874. And we have this infamous battle fight at Adobe Walls, you know, and that was the excuse the army was waiting for because they didn't want to have the tribes, to put it mildly, running around without supervision. And most historians say that there were between 200 and 400 teepees at Palo Duro Canyon in September 1874. And Mackenzie scored, you know, a tremendous victory. I'm not sure about that. I visited the Palo Duro Canyon several times. I even rented a horse, and I'd never been on a horse before. But it seems to me it's going to be... I was scared out of my wits. It seems to me it's going to be difficult to place up to 400 teepees there, and also 2,000 horses. And also, if you look at the older sources like George Bird Grinnell and stuff like that, it's clear that they saw Mackenzie on top of the canyon, and when they saw him coming, they just packed up and left. So also, when you look at the number of casualties, I think Army reports one killed or one wounded. Mackenzie got an arrow in his thigh, and there were, I think, three Indians reported killed. So it's a skirmish, if anything. And everybody says, you know, it's strange to me, because when I visited the Palo Duro Canyon the first time, you know, it's, if you've been there, it's totally flat. And I was looking at, where is the canyon? It's like a line made by pencil, you see first, and then it opens up, you know. But if the Indians are unhorsed, if Mackenzie had captured an entire horse herd, there wouldn't be any problem to catch pedestrians on top of the canyon afterwards. But strangely, he doesn't make any attempt to do so. So, first of all, the Indians would not have lost their horses, all of them. And secondly, there weren't that many. And thirdly, allegedly, the Quadi Comanches, Quanah Parker, was supposed to be at Palo Duro Canyon, but he was not. They were not. The Quadi Comanches were not there. And like I said, the Chinese just packed up and left before Mackenzie came down into the canyon.
Moving on to the Sioux hunting bands component, what indication was there that the Sioux hunting bands were united in their purpose of remaining free long before the Great Sioux War started? That's the first part. And then can you also focus on Sitting Bull, who provided your political and religious cohesion in their endeavor?
First of all, after the 1868 treaty, when the Sioux forced the closure of the Bozeman Road and burned down three fortresses, one of the few wars that the federal government lost, quite a few of the Native Americans went to the reservations. One of the more famous is, of course, Red Cloud, with a large part of the Oglala Sioux. But quite a few Sioux from many tribes decided they didn't want to have to do anything with the government. Like I mentioned earlier, you know, about a third of them refused to have anything to do with the government, to sign treaties and be confined to a reservation. And they went and supported Sitting Bull, who was a strong spokesman for non-reservation Indians. And also, Sitting Bull's authority was derived not just because of his skill as a warrior, but because he was a well-known medicine man.
You also argue that, unable to defeat the Oglala Sioux hunting bands in the field, the federal government and the army tried diplomacy instead, using the agency Indians as intermediaries. Can you elucidate the goals and also, of course, identities of these agency Indians?
Yes, fairly easy, because are you familiar with George Hyde and all his books? Yes. I thought he wrote a rather fabulous one on Spotted Tail Folks, the Brule Sioux, and one of the things that I gleaned from that book was that Spotted Dale was supposed to be an agency Indian, but that's really in quotation marks, because he used his connection to white people and several times cut loose from white authorities. So if he could go out, and he went out, could go out and induce Crazy Horse and perhaps Sitting Bull to come into the reservation, he will, of course, carry favors with white authorities. Besides, I think he left with 30 warriors, or maybe even more. So he took the chance or possibility to go out looking for Crazy Horse as a way of cutting loose from white authorities. And for leadership of the Sioux, he was in intense competition with Red Cloud. And he also went out. They tried to further their own political position and also gain favor with white authorities.
What was the fate? This is kind of a follow-up question. What was the fate of Sitting Bull? You mentioned in your book that Sitting Bull, even on the reservation, was a strong voice for independence. He was possibly murdered. Can you elaborate?
He was murdered.
Yes. Okay.
He was. He went to Canada, as you may know, and he said, "I would stay there because he asked the Canadian authorities for a reservation." And there's a lot of international interesting diplomacy about this, so that's something I might be looking into later. Because I went to the Public Records Office in London and I found quite a lot of stuff from the British side on Sitting Bull's sojourn in Canada. So he requested a reservation from the British authorities or Canadian authorities, but they turned it down because of pressure from the United States. And sometimes in 1879, 1880, the Canadian buffalo is extinct, or at least it doesn't return north of the border. So Sitting Bull says, "I don't want to come back to a reservation as long as there's a mouse to be eaten on the prairie." But in 1881, he was forced to surrender because there was simply nothing to eat. So from 1881 to 1890, he was a strong spokesperson for the Sioux, trying to avoid further loss of land and maintenance of culture. With the ghost dance in 1890, the agent feared that Sitting Bull might lead more opposition. So he sent Indian police to arrest him. And while I wouldn't say resisting arrest, but not being overly enthusiastic to go with Indian police, Red Tomahawk killed him and his son in 1890.
So you conclude that the end section of your book that with the surrender of Sitting Bull, the War of the Prairie came to a close. Native American military resistance was no longer possible nor an option afterward. Why was it no longer possible nor an option afterward? So that's the first part of the question. Second part of the question is, when fighting, the hunting bands had made the unpardonable sin of humiliating all arms of the federal government. For this, they had to pay. So the first part of the question is why, you know, how was military resistance no longer an option? And then what did this U.S. revenge that was to be thorough entail?
Okay. It's a large question. First of all, as part of coming into the archive, I was about to say to the archives, so probably a little later, coming into the reservations, part of the deal was to give up their arms and ammunition. So they simply didn't have any means to resist. Furthermore, the buffalo in the north were extinct in 1883. So there was neither resources to stay out. So that takes care of that. Also, the longer you go, you know, there's going to be more white settlements, more railroads. So it's going to be difficult to, in any case, to maintain an independent existence. What we see after 1887 with the Dawes Act, when the reservations were divided up, is that, and now I speak of all Native Americans, two-thirds of the Native American land base was lost between 1887 and 1934. And on reservations, the rations were often inadequate. People starved. Kids were kidnapped to put in boarding schools, where they often contracted tuberculosis, trachoma, other diseases. And there was no medical help on the reservation. So the American Native American population reached its low point totally in the United States of around 1900, I think, because of the conditions offered on the reservations. And I see that part of it is not just neglect, but it's, in my view, my interpretation, it's revenge for opposing the American authorities.
Were boarding schools, you mentioned already the Dawes Act and the allotment, were boarding schools and the kidnapping of Native American children, which, if possible, you can touch on, was that part of this revenge?
You know, when you say revenge in that sense, you know, when I step back, okay, when I step back and see at the total picture, you see that conditions for Native Americans deteriorate in all respects, in terms of land base, in terms of health, in terms of longevity, everything, right? Number of diseases. So the slogan from the for the white government was that we have to destroy the tribes to save the individual Indian. So it's a rather tough attack on Native American culture. And that's why Native American kids were kidnapped and put in boarding school, where they took shaved off their hair, you know, and put them on in white clothes and basically industrial schools. And they had very, very poor diet and very poor accommodations. And it was so if one child contracted tuberculosis, most of them would do so because of the living conditions. So when Native Americans refused to give up their children, the army was sent in to grab them.
The very last section of your book, you argue, federal Indian policy was designed in its practical implications, despite all the rhetorical flourish to the contrary, to bring Native Americans to extinction. Around the turn of the 19th century, there was much talk of the vanishing Indian, as the Native American population was at its low ebb in 1900 with about 180,000 peoples. Destruction of the Native American population was, of course, the real aim of the policy, which we did when we disregard the rhetoric and look at the results of the Dawes Act and other initiatives. The policies to bring about their extinction seemed to succeed brilliantly, but fortunately, in the end, they failed. It is a testament to the resilience and courage of Native Americans that not only did they survive, but were also able to maintain much of their culture and land base under these varying trying circumstances. So you ultimately argue that these Native peoples survived and persisted. Okay, what are examples that you can provide of this survival and the persistence, especially among the Sioux and the Cheyenne?
Yeah, the Cheyenne is a really interesting case, you know, because particularly the Northern Cheyennes. I already mentioned the little fingernail ledger. And this was caused by Northern Cheyennes that were forcibly moved south and refused to stay in south. You probably know the history, the Cheyenne exodus, right? And when most reservations were broken up and Native Americans lost much of the land base, actually, I think because the Cheyennes were such a resilient and hard-fighting people, the president organized a reservation for them in 1884 and 1885, going directly against the trend, the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, which still exists today. So when most Indians lost the land base, the Cheyennes actually got more land. And I think that's a testament to their fighting abilities, both politically and militarily.
It's very compelling. For our listeners, I always have this question: what can we expect from you next? Is there any books that you are working on that you can disclose at this time? Any projects or any vacations that you plan on taking?
You know, I organized our PhD seminar and invited publishers and the guy who is running Hearst Publishers in the United States and Oxford University Press in the United Hearst Publishers in England and Oxford University Press in United States. He heard about my project and he was wildly enthusiastic because I mentioned I'd like to write a more popular book on Native Americans and not just, you know, the current book you have in your hand is much like an argument, right? It's like to fill out the stuff because there's the famous example of when Sitting Bull is evolving to the Great Spirit before the Battle of Little Bighorn. And they take 50 pieces of skin of each of his arms. You know, he's dancing all night and suddenly have a vision that soldiers are falling into the camp. I don't say anything about that. I just say he provides ideological and religious coherence to the tribes. So I like to expand more, you know. And also, since this has given me a framework, I like, for instance, to go to where the Fetterman fight took place, because I can't say that 2,000 Indians were hiding there to attack the soldiers, but I've been there several times that I can't imagine that 2,000 Indians can hide anywhere there. So I'd like to just go over some of the battlefields and see if the terrain fits the accounts. So I'm looking at publishing a book on that.
So a biography of Sitting Bull, and then
no, and more extended book on Native American warfare 1865 to 1890 on the prairie. And what I try to do, you know, in this book is look at this from Native American perspective. That's why I think ledger art is an interesting source.
I really appreciate you being on the show today, Professor.
Thank you.
So for all our listeners, this is Ryan Tripp for the New Books Network, Native American Studies channel. We'll hope you listen next time.